Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Otago and Oxford University. He's worked, of course, in business. He's been an advisor to a New Zealand Prime Minister, and he's a published author. But most important for our occasion, he's the Chief Executive Officer of Fit Academia, one of Australia's leading companies, and he's going to speak to us tonight on public good, public companies, and the future of quality journalism. So we'll have our normal talk for about half an hour, then we'll have questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock. Mr. Kirk, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard, and thank you for this opportunity to address the Sydney Institute this evening. I very much wanted to speak to the Institute because of the great attention that has been paid to Fairfax Media and the decisions we have taken to restructure and drive improvements across our entire business, the corporate side and the editorial side in Australia and in New Zealand. I want to preface my remarks by explaining who we are, because a lot of the public do not appreciate what Fairfax Media is today, how we have grown, the changes we have instigated, and what our future prospects truly are. 3 years ago, we embarked on an aggressive strategy of diversification and growth in order to secure Fairfax Media's leadership and our future. As a result, the Fairfax Media of today is not your father's John Fairfax Holdings Limited. A lot of people still think of us as the Age, Sydney Morning Herald company. That company is long gone. Today, the earnings from those newspapers are less than 20% of the company's total earnings of around $830 million at the EBITDA line. The old John Fairfax Holdings from 5 years ago today contributes only 35% of our total earnings. Our earnings from our online businesses are 15% of the total. That's just under $115 million and growing rapidly. Thanks to the merger with Rural Press, we have over 300 mastheads in regional, community, and agricultural publishing. And they are, in the main, leaders in their markets. We're also the largest media company in New Zealand. Financial publishing led by the AFR is stronger than ever. Online, we have the leading news and information sites, strong classified positions, and several number one sites and transactions, from dating to the leading independent online funds management business. A lot of newsprint has been committed to coverage of the restructuring and business improvement program at Fairfax Media. A lot of it has not been well informed. A lot of it has failed to appreciate that in publishing there are many markets and that we are doing well in most of them. In print, we have regional and community publishing, financial publishing, and agricultural publishing, magazine publishing, and publishing in New Zealand. All of those businesses have medium to strong growth prospects. Metropolitan publishing in Sydney and Melbourne will have flatter growth, but this is not wag the dog. Fairfax Media has a diversified group of print assets that will, taken together, grow well in the future. We are, of course, an increasingly integrated media company, but each business has particular economics and, importantly, particular potential. Where there is opportunity to improve the short-run performance without mortgaging future performance, we have an obligation to do that. And that is what our restructure is all about. Given the recent carnage in the markets and the threat of a deep slowdown in the pace of growth here, the announcements we made in August look very prudent today. we were indeed ahead of the curve. When things get tough, what do families do? They sit around the kitchen table and they pull their belts in. Now that doesn't mean there is no future or better days ahead. And that is what we have done at Fairfax Media. On the corporate side, we have streamlined operations, restructured some functions, such as IT and HR, into the business units, and increased efficiency and productivity. On the editorial side, we have looked especially at the metropolitan newspapers, the Sydney Morning Herald, the Sun Herald, the Age, and the Sunday Age. These are the businesses with fundamental revenue challenges, but they are also the businesses with the greatest opportunities for improved processes and therefore cost improvement. Most of the changes are in how the newspapers are put together, the production side, as opposed to the reporting side. In the main, technology continues to drive production efficiencies and we intend to take advantage of it. This has been a fact of life since Gutenberg first invented the printing press, and it remains an unstoppable force. The same issues are being played out at great newspapers worldwide. In a recent note to staff, the publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Sulzberger, said, "Given the business challenges we face, we are constantly looking for ways to reduce costs that do not affect the quality or quantity of journalism we provide to our readers." That has been exactly our approach. The publishers, together with the editors, looked at each part of their businesses and assessed where things could be improved. It's a bottom-up driven process, not a draconian top-down dictate. There has been a vigorous and passionate reaction to the decisions that have been taken. As can be the case when the editorial staff are made redundant, the question has been put, will this affect quality journalism at Fairfax Media? Lastly, because of that bottom-up process, we can say that we are confident that these changes will be made without loss of quality in our journalism, the quality that distinguishes Fairfax Media publications. I'll amplify on this and discuss what I believe are the elements of quality journalism very shortly. What we have done has also spurred discussion of how Fairfax Media, as a publicly listed company, without the benefit of a capital structure that separates voting shares from ordinary shares, which is the type of structure in place for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and News Corporation, among others, can contribute to fulfill the public good in the media world. Can we keep doing what we have been doing? Indeed, in these tumultuous financial times, it's pertinent to ask, in addition to whether Fairfax Media will continue to fulfill its commitment to provide quality journalism in the years ahead, what is the future of print journalism generally? So first, in journalism today, what is the public good? In the 21st century, it is just not the same, being Zeus as it used to be. We still have the traditions, history and authority of being a leading, trusted source of news and information. But it has changed dramatically in an age of increased competition across all media, driven in large part by the internet. Our print newspapers are no longer the gatekeepers, the first point of authoritative contact with the world on any given morning. We still do set the news agenda for the electronic media, there's no doubt about that, and we set the news agenda because we have the resources to do it. But by the time you read our papers, most of you will have already had the headlines from breakfast radio, possibly been on the internet, and seen the news on TV the night before. Our newspapers, therefore, will tell you as much about why something has happened as opposed to what did happen. This has been the new mission for newspapers for many years now. Not the only mission, of course. In addition, we have to continue to surprise readers with news and insights and commentary and analysis on things they did not expect to see. We aim to provide an enrichment and understanding and context to the world that's exceptionally appealing, informative, provocative, and entertaining. Our metro newspapers certainly retain their clout. When there is a page one story or campaign on a major issue that makes news and influences opinion and is indeed serious business, But my point is that there are many more voices, many more points of access to news through the day, many more platforms, and many more options for our readers and audiences. With all this competition, and with news becoming in many instances a commodity, our only hope is to be very good. Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post, has said, other forms of media, including television and the internet, provide that same information. But the guy who gives the information first won't always be the one who gives best. We want to be best. So what is the public good that Fairfax Media should serve in this world? With respect to that, I'm a classic conservative. A free press is a pillar of our democracy. A free press is essential to the operation of democracy, and if we are to fulfil our public trust, we need to operate a vigorous media. We shine a light. We undertake investigative journalism, costly and time-consuming that it is. We report on governments, businesses, sporting associations, cultural bodies, and whoever has a public trust and obligation to serve the people. In addition, we provide insight and information that helps people come to their own conclusions about political and social issues. We encourage and facilitate meaningful engagement by citizens in a civic society. We have privileged access to people in positions of power. By passing on our reports and views and opinions, we transfer that privilege to our readers. This is a hallmark of Fairfax Media's quality, independent journalism. Of course, we also therefore have an obligation to be accountable for what we do and how we do it, and for the quality of our journalism to our readers, to the public, and to our shareholders. Now, can a public company provide quality journalism? And in particular, a public company without a controlling shareholder or two-tier share structure? We ultimately believe not only that we can survive, but that we can thrive as a public company. The model that has sustained print newspapers in metropolitan markets has fundamentally changed. In particular, the internet has waged an all-out attack on classified advertising in print. In the United States and the United Kingdom, the most mature newspaper markets in the world have been particularly devastated. Here in Australia, the Heralds and the Age also face significant structural challenges, compounded at present by a weak economy in Sydney and Melbourne. We have long recognised that the metropolitan newspaper publishing business model, dependent as it has been for many years on lineage classified advertising, simply has to change. This is not new news, and it should not be a surprise. And we are managing and adapting and evolving as a result. In a moment, I'll tell you how I believe we can and will succeed. But I must say it is galling to have to listen to the self-appointed experts prattle from the sidelines. Some people think we should just give up the fight. Eric Beecher, who has been a poisonous critic of our company for reasons best known to himself, is one of those. He was asked recently about our future on Late Line in August, and this is what he said. Virginia Trioli put the question, Eric Beecher, what would you do with Fairfax if you got your hands on it tomorrow? Mr. Beecher, well, the first option is sell it, or break it up and sell it. That's what I would do. Virginia Trioli, you wouldn't bother with trying to stick with this behemoth? Beecher, well, the problem is if you owned 100% of it and there wasn't a share market to deal with, yeah, you could do lots of things with it. Could actually say, as the New York Times does, and to some extent the Washington Post, the journalism is the centre of the fabric of what we do, and that comes first, and we'll deal with the profits separately in some other way. But whilst you've got a share register which is just open like theirs, no, I don't think there's anything you can do. So there you go. A self-proclaimed champion of the cause of quality journalism in Australia, and the publisher of that quality online site, Crikey, telling us to roll over and die. Well, we won't be throwing in the towel. And Michael Gawenda, a former editor of The Age, gave a speech last week in the Beecher tradition. His prescription was for a newspaper with a smaller circulation, a premium cover price, and no lifestyle sections. And he said that such a paper would require I quote, a smaller staff than the staff producing today's paper. I dare say under Gawinda there would be many more staff cuts at the Herald and the Age than we have contemplated. Gawinda also asked whether this paper would be profitable, and he said, I think so. Well, as CEO, I don't have the luxury of just thinking about whether something will work. I put our shareholders' money on the line every day on business decisions that will work. I'm reminded of one of my favourite US presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, who gave a famous speech a century ago at the Sorbonne in Paris. It was the man in the arena speech, some of you may know. Roosevelt said, it's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood. Shame on the man of cultivated taste who permits refinement to develop into fastidiousness that unfits him for doing the rough work of a workaday world. Well, if today's economic crisis isn't a workaday world, I don't know what is. But the point is, we don't need chicken littles. We need those who care about quality journalism, care about what we do, to band together and work with us to ensure we reach a stronger future. Some critics of Fairfax Media point to News Corporation as an example of what should be done to continue to promote quality journalism. I'm an admirer of Mr. Murdoch and News for all of their achievements. But it is critical to recognise that News Corp's publishing business, because of its corporate structure, scale and voting stock, is simply not subject to the same market requirements for performance as is Fairfax Media. The trick is not to cross-subsidise. There is no trick to cross-subsidise. The trick is to develop an overall high-performance company that enables continued development and success of a metropolitan publishing business in the context of a diversified multimedia company which delivers acceptable growth overall. And that is exactly what we're doing. Every step we have taken over the past 3 years to meet all the challenges of technological evolution and audience fragmentation, which have been a part of media's history since the printing press was invented, is based on a simple three-pronged strategy. First, defending and growing our newspapers and magazine publications. Newspapers are the core of our history and heritage. They give the company its values and meaning. In this digital age, we simply do not have the luxury, economically or culturally, of throwing out the printed word. As media products, our newspapers are constantly evolving and developing. Editorial product development, from strong editorial leadership, is central to our future, as is the continued development of successful advertising products. And we have the results to prove our success. With steady to growing circulation and sharp contrast to major broadsheets in Europe and North America. We believe in the future of our newspapers, and we are taking the hard steps to ensure that they are firmly positioned to compete and succeed and retain their distinctive qualities in the digital age. Second, in our strategy, seeking aggressive growth in the digital businesses I mentioned earlier. We own 100% of our online portfolio, unlike any other major print publishing company anywhere in the world. Taken together, we have 16.5 million unique browsers per month, up 15% year on year, off a huge base. We have the number one news sites in the country, strong classified sites, and we have the leading transaction sites in investment, dating and accommodation. We have in the past year expanded with the first new online newspapers in Australia, in Brisbane and Perth, and in the process created a national platform for advertising and news. We have greatly built up the websites of the former Rural Press mastheads, driving news leadership and e-commerce in regional and rural Australia. This was one of the benefits we highlighted in merging with Rural Press. We have a comprehensive internet strategy that is massively successful and second to none in assets and prospects. Our third strategic pillar is to build an integrated digital media company. Our strategy is to build a digital media company that creates, distributes, and monetizes content across many different media platforms. Newspapers, magazines, the internet, mobile phones, and whatever else it makes sense for us to be. A simple way we think of it is that we are in the process of transforming Fairfax Media into a multimedia news and information company. We have a long way to go, but we have begun the process of converging editorial content development and management, and brand management, and sales across our distribution platforms. For us, preparing for the digital age means that the future of Fairfax depends on how well we build on what we are today. The key question then becomes, does Fairfax Media have in its history, its DNA, the fundamental attributes or capabilities to succeed in the digital world? The answer is yes, because the most fundamental attributes of success in the news and information business in the digital age are what we have in spades, namely content, audience, and brands. So let me turn to those. First, content. We have the two largest newsrooms in the country in Sydney and Melbourne, and they will remain so. More than 350 journalists in each city. In addition, we have more than 250 newsrooms across the country and in New Zealand. We have correspondents in New York, Washington, London, Jerusalem, New Delhi, and China and Indonesia. And we have hundreds more journalists at the Financial Review and business magazines and at our extensive agricultural publications. We generate international content, national content, specialised financial and agricultural content, and of course lots and lots of local content. Our content is available, is made available on multiple platforms. Our metro papers and their websites, given their editorial mandate and prominence, are national platforms. We launched our online news businesses in Queensland and Western Australia so that we could provide content from those markets to the national news network. That local content can also be relevant for national distribution. Our content is also what I call local as well. News and information and reporting that have the strongest relevance to the media community, gathered locally for local consumption. This is a particular attribute of our regional and community newspapers. Hyperlocal remains the bread and butter of a trusted source in these sometimes far spread out communities. We're evolving the content all the time, whatever technology will enable us to do. It's not just text and photos. Video is simply indispensable to what we offer each day. And we have nearly 4 million video downloads per month from our news websites. If narrowband was net bad for newspapers, and that it allowed the building of online classified sites that have lowered price points and taken volume from the papers, then I believe that fast broadband will be net good for newspapers, principally because it will allow us to develop video content and video advertising formats that will compete with free-to-air and paid television with their protected distribution systems. Since its founding, Fairfax has been a content company. In my judgment, fit-for-purpose content is and will forever remain king. Our second core attribute is audiences. We have local and national audiences, and international too. There's about a third of the traffic to the smh.com.au and the age.com.au comes from overseas. And our audiences are growing dramatically. Take the Sydney Morning Herald, for example. It has a circulation of around 212,000 on weekdays, 358,000 on weekends. There's a readership of well over a million on Saturdays. Online, it has 4.2 million unique browsers per month, up over 30% on a year ago. The Age has similar figures. At 177 years old, in other words, the Sydney Morning Herald is reaching more people in more places than ever before in its history. And the same is true for The Age, and it's in its 154th year. This same story is being repeated across the country, in metro markets, regional and rural markets, financial publishing in our magazines, and with our radio stations, in New Zealand, and of course, online. What changes so dramatically is how technology alters the ways in which we can reach our audiences, and how our audience interacts with us. The era of the dominance of one-way mass audience communications is long gone. As I said earlier, we are no longer Zeus. Today, we can connect with them, but increasingly the audience wants to choose how they will engage with us. The important point for Fairfax Media is that we have shown that our audiences come with us as we build new products in response to the internet and digitisation, and that we're able to extend and broaden our audiences through these new media. Our third basic attribute is brands. We have some of the most powerful brands in the country, and they sure carry an emotive wallop. Indeed, a lot of the public reaction to our restructure that I mentioned at the outset is because our audience feels very invested in the brands and because of what they stand for. In that sense, a lot of the debate and discussion has actually been very heartening to us because of the relevance of what we do for so many readers and listeners, in print, on air, and online. And their message is to reinforce exactly what we want, to continue the high-quality journalism that's so important to them and to the strength of our brands. Our brands, therefore, are the glue in the relationship we have with our audiences, built as they are on our long history of journalism of the highest quality. For over 175 years, our mastheads have been the newspapers that champion the community and dare to make power accountable. The challenge for us as a company is to stretch the brands, to modernise them, so that they are as powerful in the 21st century as they are as they were in the 19th and 20th centuries. We do not know specifically what will come in the years ahead, but I do know this. If we're going to be successful, we have to understand where we came from and build on it. If we're going to be successful, we have to be innovative. And we innovate from the powerful base of our content, audiences, and brands. Armed with these strengths, we believe we can hold our position in the new world. Certainly our conclusion is we're as well positioned as anyone in traditional media worldwide. Therefore, what is the future of print media and quality journalism? I believe quality independent journalism has several elements. As I've said, first and foremost, shining a light, telling the truth, making powerful governments and people and powerful people accountable, and doing so with the fundamental values of accuracy, fairness, and balance. Carl Bernstein and Watergate fame has consistently defined the mission of journalism and reporting as delivering the best obtainable version of the truth. That's what we have to be able to deliver, day in, day out. Great journalism is important on any given day, but in this era of enormous financial and economic uncertainty, something we have not experienced to this extent since the Great Depression, the premium placed on quality news that is clear and sharp and informative is at its greatest. Second, quality journalism. To deliver quality journalism requires a critical mass. We absolutely need a certain number of journalists dedicated to getting news and information. But at the same time, you can drive a meritocracy in journalism just as you can in any institution based on intellectual capital. And quality journalism demands no less. Quality is just not about numbers, how many journalists you have. It is about performance and what our journalists produce. Quantity does not equal quality. A stronger meritocracy provides renewal and permits generational change, critical to any dynamic institution. The expectations of our Gen Y journalists and their future and opportunities for training and growth need to be accommodated. Another element of the quality journalism we aspire to in relation to the cities in which we publish is comprehensiveness. Being comprehensive means, of course, not just news, business and sport, but the arts, lifestyle, culture, science, health, the environment, and all levels of politics and society. We also need our people overseas, so Australian eyes and ears are capturing world events and informing our audiences about it. Australians need to make up their own minds in the context of Australia's interests, and having Australians shape that worldview is very important. In an age of spin and PR, we also need scale and investment to do the editorial R&D required for quality journalism, to investigate, research, and develop possible stories over long periods of time, even if we have no idea at the outset if it will get to print. Quality journalism is a blend of all these things and how they interact in a dynamic environment. The trick is to adapt, to change, and drive it to our advantage in a time of upheaval and uncertainty. Therefore, and finally, what is the future of our metropolitan newspapers? I am resolutely optimistic about their future. We have the most attractive audiences in Sydney and Melbourne. They trust us. They engage with us. They want the best from us. Everything we are doing, the diversification and growth I've outlined, the emphasis on content, audiences, and brands, is to ensure our success editorially and commercially. For a public company engaged in pursuing the public good, quality journalism and commercial success have a symbiotic relationship. They can only go forward together. We simply cannot afford to pay for the quality journalism we aspire to if we are not profitable. Managing to success in both objectives is the holy grail. It's hard to see more than 10 to 20 years out. 10 years ago, the internet was in its infancy and Google did not exist. AOL offered dial-up, walled gardens, and broadband was a pipe dream. So it's hard to forecast what we will be in 2020. But it is not hard to say what we aspire to and what we believe today. My belief is that in large cities such as Sydney and Melbourne, there most definitely is a vigorous and profitable market among the educated and higher income audiences we primarily attract for a quality broadsheet newspaper that provides news across a range of interests and disciplines. It tells our readers what has happened and why, which is turned to regularly for insight, perspective and sheer enjoyability because of the quality of the writing and presentation. I believe this market for the quality broadsheets we produce is in the range of 200,000 to 300,000 circulation, higher of course on weekends as is the case today, and that these newspapers will continue to provide a superb advertising platform through with less classified and much more display advertising. And they will be commercially successful. More modestly, as a pure print product than in their heyday. But when taken as an integrated media proposition, we will continue to have a profitable and growing metropolitan media business. A stable, high-value print audience, paying a higher cover price because of the quality independent journalism they are getting, buttressed commercially by strong display and display classified revenues in print, working in tandem with very large national online audiences, which in turn attract new sources of advertising dollars, such as online video. These are the commercial keys to our future of metropolitan multimedia publishing. I know Fairfax Media as a public company will continue to serve the public good with high quality journalism. And perhaps more than any of our peers anywhere in the world, we will also be able to deliver new avenues of growth and shareholder returns well into the future. Thank you for your attention.
Many thanks, David. Yes, so we come to questions and discussion, but before we do, I should say thanks also to Alison for the use of this fund facility. If I just lead off, you were making the point earlier in your speech that newspapers in Australia, including Sydney Morning Herald, has held up very well in sales compared with North America and Western Europe. Why do you think that has been the case? Why do you think, in spite of all the challenges, our papers have done well in this area?
I think there are a number of reasons. Market structure is important. In Australia, there are a very limited number of national newspapers, Australian Financial Review and the business niche, and Australian is a more general newspaper. But really, the market in Australia is built on major metropolitan city newspapers. If you go to the United Kingdom, there are something like 7 national newspapers that can reach the whole country with very easy distribution because of the density of population. In the US, there are a number of national newspapers, 3, but far greater number of smaller regional newspapers competing with each other. So market structure and the number of newspapers per capita is important, I think. People are focused on big mastheads. But I also think that those of you who have travelled and seen international papers, of course, with the exception of the very big metropolitan newspapers, which are fine papers around the world, there's a lot of rubbish out there. There's a lot of poor newspapers. Very poor use of colour, poor investment in design, and I think some of the newspapers in parts of the world, perhaps particularly in the United States, have got themselves into a cycle of cross-cutting and no capital investment in colour facilities or development of the editorial product, or in some of the advertising products, that they put out a poorer product in a more competitive environment, and they've suffered in circulation as a result.
Thank you. Richard.
David, could I ask a question about the shareholder position and growth, and you contrasted Fairfax and News, and you were talking about the additional capital or the additional money that News might be able to be putting into its newspapers relative to what you can do with your particular ownership structure. And I'm just thinking, from the Murdoch point of view, it would seem, as has been said many times, that the use of the newspapers, their leadership in the thought development of the community, has led to a political influence which has then allowed News to acquire regulatory approval in the United States, in Britain, whether it was BSkyB or whatever it was, to have had the extraordinary growth that that company has had. So I'd just like you to comment, if you could, on what would appear to be different growth ambitions with different ways of going about it, even if you've got the cost of the newspapers to get the overall growth opportunity.
Well, it's very difficult for me to comment on News Corporation's strategy over a long period of time, so I'll leave that, because it's not something I'm familiar with. But the point I was trying to make, and I think it is an important one, is people contrast the companies, is because publishing is such a large proportion of the earnings of Fairfax, we absolutely have to get a cost of capital and an appropriate return on that for our shareholders, which means we need to grow our earnings per share from publishing every year. It means we can't put up with loss-making businesses. We have to turn them into profitable businesses. It doesn't mean we can't invest capital in printing presses and product development and all the things we need to do to drive the business forward, and we certainly do that. But it does mean that as a public company for which the publishing assets are a much greater part of the overall business, it's the performance of those publishing assets that's right under the spotlight. And News Corporation is really largely a United States-based film and television and entertainment company, although, of course, it's a very global company. So it's just a very different set of business performance metrics that business needs to be is judged against compared to Fairfax.
One of the things that's often discussed recently in terms of the problem for newspapers, the generic newspaper, is the fact that with online news, online reading, online information, more and more people are able to only read what they want to read. How does this affect the generic production of the news each day when you have to produce a product which suits all sorts of people? When out there in maybe the under 30s or the over 80s, they're just looking for what they want to read.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I actually think it's something I didn't really talk about much in the speech, but I do think it's something that goes to the nature of the public good, or the what newspapers can develop. It's an edited version of the world, or what's going on in the world, and in the local community, and all sorts of ways I've talked about comprehensiveness. I think for people to lead fully informed and fully engaged lives in civic society and in the community around them, it's great for them to have exposure to a whole range of different things. If you turn the pages of a great broadsheet newspaper such as ours, you'll get exposed to so many interesting and different and funny things. And there's a lot of serendipity in the newspaper. You see interesting things and you latch on and read it. I think it's one of the great virtues and values of newspapers. So I think it's an issue, a wider issue, if we find that people are very task or specific information directed when it comes to getting their information or their news. And that would lead more to an edited sort of online approach. You might even go to a comprehensive site like smh.com.au or theage.com.au. You might end up going to some Google News or Yahoo News or someone that just creates a whole lot of headlines. That's not such an issue for us in the sense that when people go to those sites and they click on the headline, they come to our site anyway, and once we've got them there, we just keep them there. But I do think it is an issue, and I think it's a broader educational issue about people engaging in the breadth of what goes on around them. They have an answer, but I think if our newspapers can continue to champion that, That's a good thing.
Especially down the back, then we go here and go down there. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I couldn't help but noticing a brutally frank article on the New York Times website today, which is called Newspapers Web Revenue is Stalling. And it observes how newspapers saw online advertising as their salvation, but in quite a lengthy analysis, looks at the fact that after 17 quarters of ballooning growth, online revenue of newspaper sites is falling quite drastically. You mentioned that video is one of the things that Fairfax might consider delivering as a spearhead of value creation online. Just two quick questions. Firstly, do you see subscription-based access to that video becoming more important? And secondly, do you see that social networking communities, for example, which seem to be engines of growth online, might play a larger role in Fairfax's relationship with its readers going forward?
I saw the same piece in the New York Times. In the North American market, as we all know, from all sorts of sources going through all sorts of... I think New York Times, for one, actually itself has had a reasonable continued growth, and we certainly have. So very fragmented, massively competitive market, and not directly comparable to this market, just a point to make. Two good questions about the role of subscription in most of our media. No, I don't think so is the answer. I don't see, unless you had unique content, it was a movie that people had to pay for a movie, a first-run movie or something like that, very difficult to expect people to pay for it. So I think it would be very limited application of subscription-based models online for ourselves, except where there is truly unique content. Of course, our business model, that most utilise that is Fairfax Business Media, and the AFR, that's working well. And second question about social networks. There's an element of social networks in all good news and information sites, in the sense, not in the technical sense of people all, you know, having a Facebook page or a MySpace page where they have friends connected to it and they're able to do the messaging and all the things that go with that, but in the sense that people go to a place where they can all consume the same information, and of course with blogs and feedback and all the sorts of contributions we get from readers, there's that element of social network. I think the pure social networks are a much tougher online business model to monetize, largely because of the massive proliferation of pages that goes on. So the price per page goes down a lot. And also because they're very uncontrolled environments, and that's what young people like about them. In fact, they're uncontrolled environments, or at least they're uncontrolled by them and their friends. Now, which means it's often very difficult for brands with very important brand values to protect, to have themselves placed alongside uncontrolled content. So I think it's tough to monetize social networks.
There's a question here, then we go down the back, yes.
Mr. Kirk, how do you preserve the political neutrality in the Sydney Morning Herald as distinct from the political integrity? I separate the two because there are times when you would not want to be politically neutral. There are times when you'd not want to have political integrity because there'll be great attraction in dropping your political neutrality. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I think those are very good questions and very important questions. In the era of spin and PR and a great deal of non-neutrality, partiality all over the media, as people compete for voices and for audiences that will stay connected to them because they believe in the same things. Now, we don't, and we will never have the luxury of trying to develop a small audience that is partial to us because we speak their language politically. But how do you do that? Well, firstly, you have to reinforce consistently and constantly the values and expectations of people who work for the organisation. And to the great credit of our editorial people over 177 years, and the management that supported them, and the board that supported the management of the editorial, that is exactly what Fairfax has established. When you have a heritage, when you believe in something, when you think of it as the core of who you are and what you do, it's much easier to hold people to it. So that's important. And of course, you've got to appoint the right people. And you've got to have the right people in senior editorial roles, of course, and senior management roles. And then when the tough decisions come, when people are challenged on it, we have to make the right decisions. I agree with you, though, that sometimes it's not a matter of being politically neutralist. It's a matter of weighing up the pros and the cons and having a view. I think because of our privileged access and because of our the writers and the thoughtful people that we've got, and reporters who can gather the information, elections come around, for instance, and when there are issues with federal or local governments, having a newspaper weigh up the pros and the cons and having a clear opinion on it and offering advice to people because of the privileged insights they have is important. And I think in this town we've got a very credible record of holding the state government, for instance, to account relentlessly. Alas, we haven't seemed to have done much good so far, but we can stay on this, which is my guess. Because it's up to the interest, but sooner or these days we'll get some chance.
There's a question here, then we go down. I think we're going down the back, then we go here, then we go there. Okay, down the back, yeah.
Yes, thank you. I confess I should be a practitioner of PR, and we always challenge something that's immediate, it's a gap that we all have in mind. I just want to take you back to the point that you made about stretching the brand. Looking at the two products, the print version of it, say the Sydney Morning Herald and the online version, they are quite different. The online version is more, let's say, sensational, the types of story that tends to run by its front website. If, at the end of the day, the print version is not economically viable, or you can have to continue to cross-subsidize it, at some point you decide to pull it in, or not. Are we going to either have two versions of the Sydney Morning Herald, one that is more high quality, and one that's not, or we just wind up with the online version that is certainly a more substantial version than what we see in the print version, which is a very good quality paper?
It's a good question, a very hypothetical question, and I really don't see any I think the print product will continue to evolve and change. People may not already know the content and the values and the integrity of the approach, but it may look very different in 10, 15 years, but I can't see it disappearing at all, because so long as we're reaching that 200,000 to 300,000 people, high-value audience, there is by definition an economic model, so I don't think there's an issue with that. The issue about the brand and how we manage the brand and what it stands for is a very important one, and it's tough, and we're working with it, but clearly we need to be careful. There's about a 35% overlap. People that read the newspaper that also go online. So we're developing 65% of our audience online is new. Younger, very often, of course, are there for different reasons from time to time. There because they can interact. There because I do with video and slideshows. And do a whole lot of stuff to look at archives and things they couldn't otherwise do. So this is a different audience. So at the moment, it's not a major issue. We think very few people are turned off the internet site because it presents a somewhat different layout and story selection above the fold, as it were, on the internet site. But it's a good question, and it bothers us to make sure we get it right. And at the moment, I feel pretty confident that we are stretching and making the brand more all-encompassing without in any sense undermining the fundamental values that people come to us for.
Mr. Coke, in your speech you mentioned the online newspaper that you developed in Perth and in Brisbane. Leading on from the earlier question, to what extent, not specifically those, but you've got there a wonderful example of them, to what extent do you see those purely online newspapers eating the space of the physical papers over time?
I think they will. I think if we think that there is some migration of readership online, but more importantly there's a creation of new readership, people who don't interact with a paper, will interact with an online news site, then our aim is to get the majority of those people. So in a sense that they are missed opportunities for the local newspaper, which we don't have one, or there are people who migrate from the paper to online, then I think we'll be the greatest beneficiary of those in both that market and in the Brisbane market. I do think, as I've said in Sydney and Melbourne, I think that there will for a long time be a place for newspapers in Brisbane and Perth as in Sydney and Melbourne. So I don't know if newspapers won't disappear, but from our perspective, so long as we're growing our audience online, we're offering a great product, we're bringing advertisers along with us, we have been building new businesses, genuine new revenues, getting to new audiences that we could have never got to with print-only product because the economics just wouldn't support a launch in those markets. So in that sense, it's, in the digital world, while it's tough, like classified advertising and big metropolitan papers, is a great opportunity to build new brands and new opportunities for revenue growth in markets we've never been before.
Question here, yeah.
Hi, Glenn Thross. You mentioned that video content is going to be a growth area for you. Does that mean that your future revenue is going to be possibly people that would have advertised on commercial television networks?
I think, you know, there's one big, again, this is one of the opportunities that digital media has opened up for primarily print companies, newspaper publishing companies. Is that because of the internet, because of the continued evolution of broadband, fast broadband networks, of, you know, iPhones, of the ability to consume electronic media instead of to your household, the internet, but to consume it as if it was a television delivered by free-to-air or satellite TV. We're all kind of in a situation where we can attract people to content, and often it would be video content, and then bring video advertising advertisers along with that, then we can share in that pool. And I think, fortunately for us, the video people, the people who gain on video advertising today, the free-to-air networks and pay TV people, can't come back the other way. They can't invest in the newsrooms, they can't invest in the printing presses, they haven't developed the audiences and the brands that we've got. So, as I said, I think there's a fast broadband is a net positive opportunity. It's good for publishing companies. That's a long way of saying yes. And I think that we are going to be sharing in that big pool of advertising dollars, which goes to what we call, think of the TV advertising, which is really just video format advertising that will get delivered to people in a whole range of different ways, on the laptop, on the PC, on the TV, on the iPhone, or other mobile device in the future. They will all be there along with everyone else fighting for those dollars.
There's a question there. Yeah.
Of all the changes you described, have the universities kept up in changing or modifying the education and training of journalists?
I can't answer that comprehensively because I haven't really looked at it, but I think, yes, they're trying. I think they certainly understand the fragmented nature, the two-way nature of news, and are preparing people as well as possible. They probably do less of the technical training in terms of the use of video and so on than they could do. Maybe that's a result of resources. But of course the media companies need to fill that gap. And cadets or junior journalists or even more experienced journalists that are part of our organisation, we need to be training people to use the multimedia tools and think about capturing a story in a multimedia way and then understand how to manage that story to a new news cycle. The old days, of course, you went out and you talked to lots of people and you rang them up and you got your head around the story and you shut everything out and sat down for 2 hours between 4 and 6 and wrote it up and subbed it, or maybe it was a bit early. But nowadays, when you capture a story, you've got to get it on the net immediately. You've got to be managing that story as a journalist across the day, updating it, maybe filing for the net, and then writing the analytical piece, the background piece, why it all happened and where to from here for the newspaper for the next day, where people have got time and we can give it the consideration that it needs. So there's a lot of change for journalists. It's challenging for them. But if they can grab that challenge and that excitement, I think it can be, you know, a really satisfying and more comprehensive, if you like, career than ever.
Very near the end, there's a question there. Yeah,
hi. Just a point along the public good. Since the restructure and redevelopment of the company, has there been, with the idea of profit creation, has there been much need to retrench people, or has the staff pretty well been kept enough in the numbers?
No, there has been redundancies across the company. Most particularly, there's been a redundancy program announced about 2 months ago, two or three months ago. And that was across the company. It was in corporate and business services. and it was in the editorial. So we have had to trim ourselves in a number of areas, and I guess we're a lot different from a lot of other companies in the current environment.
So the final question here, yeah.
This is Kate. I work with the Ministry of Knowledge and Review and the Business Development Capacity. The question that I want to raise to the community is about change. And that's rightly so in the context of the online products that we serve. What are your thoughts on innovation for a company like us moving forward, creating a lab that can drive new ideas across the business so that the end user it is a single stop shop for them to engage across all the product ranges and the products.
I think innovation is absolutely fundamental. I think all companies are constantly thinking of ways in which they can seed innovation and they can nurture it when it pops up, and then they can turn the little thing that pops up into a fully developed plant and grow and flourish. So you've got to work at all of those levels. What I think is also very important is that the innovation is connected to the realities of the business. Because in fact, I always think strategy development needs to be very much informed by what's going on in customers and readers and the minds of people that consume the product or pay the money or rent businesses, how to make for advertising. So it needs to be close to the business. So I think it's important that each of the businesses, which understands its market, which understands its audience, which understands the technological trends and threats, is developing its own business. That's why we can innovate in its own area. So that's why we run a reasonably decentralised business model, or at least we give strong accountability to the chief executives of the different businesses, the general publishing businesses, the financial publishing, the internet, New Zealand radio. But we require them to deliver their earnings, but also to innovate and grow the business. So the challenge for me becomes, sitting more at the centre, is when good ideas come to the surface, how do we make sure that and are working, you have to diffuse them across the organisation and get the parts of the organisation to work together. We do that through a range of ways, in terms of senior team working together and communication and so on. It's an ongoing challenge for the person.
Many thanks, Mr. Cooper. Check a seat, please. We could go on for 50.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.